TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Emperors in the Jungle. The Hidden Presence of U.S. Chemical Weapons in Panama. 2 days before the invasion of Iraq, we met in the back room of a bookstore in San Francisco's Mission District. I think all of us knew that war was about to begin soon, and we had come both for companionship and to think about the very sad fact that this would not be, by any stretch of the imagination, the first invasion of a foreign country by the U.S. In fact, we heard that the tiny country of Panama had already been invaded 20 times when in 1989 a U.S. raid was launched in the name of regime change. This time it was to arrest the Panamanian president, Manuel Noriega. But the parallels did not end there. We learned that the U.S. used and tested biological and chemical weapons routinely in Panama and actually left behind 2 tons of VX nerve agents when it finally vacated the canal zone in 1999. While the people on San Jose Island in Panama don't dare touch the rusting mustard gas bombs on their beaches, the U.S. makes the case against Saddam Hussein for possession of some of the same materials they left behind in Panama. While Iraq is being punished for possession of weapons that they may or may not have, the U.S. government refuses to help in the cleanup of Panama, where they left behind enough chemical and biological weapons to poison the country for generations to come. John Lindsay Poland had come that night to talk to us about his research into this suppressed history. His book, Emperors in the Jungle, is now becoming big news. It is more than a report on chemical weapons, although Lindsay Poland did most of the original research and detective work on this. It is a history of Panama around the legacies of U.S. intervention, beginning with the building of the Panama Canal in 1904, to the poisoning of the rainforest to, quote, protect the canal, to the school of the Americas, much of this unknown to most people in the U.S., and even to many Panamanians. Here is John Lindsay Poland. He is the director of the Fellowship of Reconciliation's Task Force on Latin America and the Caribbean.
I want to thank you all for coming out in this very, very extraordinary time. What I'm going to do tonight is I'm going to talk about what's in this book, and I'm also going to try and relate what is here to our current moment. I don't really think that any of us can even think these days without considering the extraordinary moment that we're living in. I did not write a comprehensive history of the relationship between the U.S. and Panama, but I chose a number of episodes that I believed illustrate the attitude that the U.S. brought to its project in Panama. And I want to use these to talk about these episodes as a way of looking at what's going on now as the U.S. prepares to escalate its war on Iraq. And in that same spirit of using history to inform activism for right now. There are some people that say that what is going on right now is a break with the past. I've heard at least 2 lines of thinking in that vein. One is that we have never had this kind of unilateral invasion of another country before without UN backing. And I would venture to say that the invasion of Panama is certainly one story of how a one nation has invaded another nation without any kind of UN backing and was actually condemned by the international community. So the research that I did on the use of chemical weapons in Panama was quite startling and became news in itself. The history of chemical weapons in Panama begins shortly after the canal construction was finished in 1914. In the early 1920s, the army instructed all of its headquarters, regional headquarters, to come up with comprehensive defense plans. And the defense plan for the Panama Canal included a plan to use chemical weapons in case there was an invading army. The military was going to spray the beaches with mustard gas or the trails in the jungles if there was an advancing army approaching the Panama Canal. And so there were a dozen different sites in the Panama Canal zone that were used to store chemical weapons from the 1920s, at least through the mid-1940s. Beginning in World War II, the U.S. Began to, with its extended power in the Pacific and Asia, the U.S. was very interested in conducting warfare in tropical areas, and so wanted to find out how chemical weapons, as well as other weapons, behaved in a tropical environment. There was some thinking that perhaps they would be more effective in the tropics. This first began when the U.S. was trying to take over the Pacific Islands from the Japanese during World War II. And the U.S. was losing, was getting very heavy casualties in conventional warfare. And so the U.S. began to look for a place to test chemical weapons, and they found this island on the Pacific side of Panama called San Jose Island. In 1943, the U.S. established a chemical proving ground on San Jose Island, brought hundreds of soldiers there, and began to test mustard gas, phosgene, and some other poison gases on that island. Like other places during World War II, the U.S. began to use people as subjects to see how the equipment was working. There was even one test that tried to determine the difference between Puerto Rican soldiers and so-called Continental soldiers, that is, white soldiers, and how they responded if they were exposed to mustard gas. They did discover that they responded the same way. I did begin to interview some veterans, and it was very pointed lesson for me that the people who suffer from U.S. imperialism are often the people who are appointed or drafted in order to implement its plans, particularly the soldiers. Jack Cadenhead had enlisted in the Army in Greenville, South Carolina, in 1940 to escape the Depression and an oppressive job in the local cotton mill. Sent to the Canal Zone, he and others in the 33rd Infantry Regiment were brought to a long, narrow building on Fort Clayton one day in July 1941. There, they were given gas masks, exposed to a form of tear gas, and told to lift their masks and sniff it. Then the officers running the experiment asked for 10 volunteers. They said they wanted some men who didn't smoke, Cadenhead recalled. He raised his hand. It's hot, he said, close to 100 degrees in Panama, with no air conditioning, especially in those chambers. They would drop stuff in a container and it would fog up. The operators had gas masks on, Cadenhead told me, but, quote, they didn't tell us a thing. They just run us through there pretty fast. The building was long, so long that the men were forced to breathe in the mustard as they ran. The men quickly developed problems breathing and were rushed to nearby Gorgas Hospital. The guy with me, Bill Hansard, almost choked to death when we got to Gorgas, Cadenhead recalled. I was in ahead of him. He was blue around his mouth. They said, we need to get him in here. It was one of the medical aides, I think, and he asked the doctor, what's wrong with them? And the doctor said, it's that damn mustard gas. Mustard gas loves wet, low places. That's where it hangs out. It's the same on your body, where you sweat or it's humid, said Cadenhead, who has had health problems ever since. The gas affected his speech. Blisters as big as a half dollar came up on his feet, and the end of his penis turned white. I thought I had leprosy for a while, Cadenhead said. More than 50 years later, he still had problems breathing. When he wrote to the Veterans Administration, the VA wrote back to say that his records from Gorgas Hospital had been destroyed. We were all kids. We didn't know what was going on, Cadenhead said. After I got older and wiser, I felt we were used as guinea pigs. Cadenhead's experience may have reflected the decision of one or two field commanders, because widespread use of human subjects for chemical tests did not begin until 1943. Soon enough, it would become a matter of policy. In early 1944, the Navy conducted a four-day gas exercise with what one officer described as a rugged group of Marines. The ordeal was so grueling that some of the Marines tried to maim themselves. The officer recounted that he prepared the naval hospital for, quote, severe casualties, then set out for Camp Chorrera, where the exercise took place. 30 minutes after the maneuver began on February 21st, the Marines were sprayed by air with CNB tear gas. 3 men were evacuated because of gas burns on the first day, he wrote. 2 more men were evacuated the next day. And by the third day, quote, all the lesions are getting progressively worse, approximately 60 hours after exposure. There are 2 other casualties, one already described. The other one has gone over the hill, unquote. A week later, several men were still in the hospital with burns approaching third degree. On the night of March 3rd, one of the Marines tossed a live shell into a campfire and shot himself in the arm. This history went on until 1948, when after World War II, the U.S. attempted to maintain its bases outside the canal zone in the interior of Panama. The U.S. had had over 100 military sites in the interior of Panama during World War II. And when it tried to extend this arrangement, Panama rebelled. There was a mass mobilization in the cities, and the Legislative Assembly was forced to turn down a treaty that would have maintained the bases in the interior of Panama. And we see this history repeated again in the 90s, which I'll come back to in a second. And so the U.S. was forced to evacuate from San Jose Island and discontinue its chemical exercises for the next 4 years. But it recontinued the exercises in areas in the canal zone in the 1950s. And when the war in Southeast Asia began to escalate in the 60s, the U.S. established what was called the Tropic Test Center, which was designed to test all kinds of material in a tropical environment. And by that time, the U.S. and other countries had developed much more powerful chemical weapons, the nerve agents, which is part of what has been discussed in Iraq lately, and tested VX nerve agent and sarin gas in 1964 to 68. We uncovered some records that show that the U.S. in 1964 shipped 3 tons of VX nerve agent mines to Panama. And these were tested, about 1 ton of these were tested between 1964 and 68. Not all of them were detonated while they were there. Some of them were disposed in the ocean. But there is no record of 2 tons of VX agent being shipped back from Panama to the United States. And I bring this up because the discussion in the UN today about, in the last weeks, about the Iraq's stocks of chemical weapons has focused on records that Iraq has of having produced a certain number of tons, 4 tons, of VX nerve agent, and not having adequate records of having destroyed all that VX nerve agent. They don't have the records that say that they got rid of it, and so the U.S. and Hans Blix are presuming that they still have it, and they may very well still have it. And yet in Panama, the United States brought in 3 tons of VX nerve agent, only has record of 1 ton being shipped out of Panama, and yet it's somehow not an issue. I agree when Colin Powell says that VX nerve agent is an extremely dangerous substance. 5 milligrams is lethal. So it is an extremely dangerous substance. And the fact that the United States can't account for what it brought in is a very serious issue. In 1997, the U.S. ratified the Chemical Weapons Convention, which requires all those who ratify it to declare and to destroy all chemical weapons that have been abandoned on another nation's territory. In the case of the U.S. and Panama, there's very clear evidence of the U.S. Leaving chemical weapons on San Jose Island, and there is documentary evidence of having left chemical weapons in the canal area. When the U.S. made its declaration to the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Warfare in 1997, it said that it had not abandoned chemical weapons in any other nation. Panama, a year later, said that, in fact, the U.S. had abandoned chemical weapons in Panama. The U.S. has not yet responded to that declaration. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons sent technical inspectors to San Jose Island and confirmed that there are 500-pound and 1,000-pound mustard bombs exposed and still live on San Jose Island, and the United States has still not responded to that declaration. And so the United States is in violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention, which is the only regime in international law that deals with chemical weapons, which you would think would be very relevant today. So the last thing I want to talk about is the invasion and its consequences. As I said, this is not the first time that a Bush administration has conducted a regime change through invasion of another country without the UN approval. The invasion of Panama is a very good example. And one thing I want to recall about that is not only the consequences that it has in the invaded country, but also the precedent that it sets. 8 months after the U.S. invaded Panama in 1989, Iraq invaded Kuwait. And it's often an ally to a superpower who has done pretty well, like, for example, the Noriega government had done with the United States, or like Saddam Hussein had done with the United States in the 1980s, will often miscalculate the approval that they have with the superpower. And I think this is one of the things that happened with Manuel Noriega, and it's also one of the things that happened with Saddam Hussein when he invaded Kuwait. But it's certainly a precedent that the invasion of Panama set. So I'm just going to read a little bit from the book about the invasion. Most of those displaced and killed during the invasion lived in El Chorillo, the neighborhood next to PDF, Panama Defense Forces headquarters, that burned to the ground, although many Panamanians died from gunfire and rocket attacks as well. The chorilleros were mostly blacks and mestizos, whose families lived in tenement buildings that had been built for West Indian laborers during the canal construction era. The impoverished community of San Miguelito was also bombed. Across town, at Punta Paitillo, wealthy Panamanians watched the invasions from their condominiums and expensive high-rises. At nearby Paitilla Airport, Navy SEALs were ordered to undertake a risky operation to disable Noriega's personal jet at close range to avoid damage to nearby residences from crossfire. 4 SEALs lost their lives in the operation. No such care was taken with the PDF headquarters next to El Chorillo, where U.S. forces bombed from the air. There, tracer bullets and flares contributed to the conflagration that incinerated the community and many people who were trapped inside. Across the isthmus in Colón, the Caribbean port populated mostly by Afro-Caribbean blacks, the victims were similarly dark-skinned. When looting of city businesses threatened to move into the gated warehouses of the Colón Free Zone, which is a free market zone, warehouse zone, armed businessmen began shooting at the looters, killing 3. The businessmen asked for military help and were joined by U.S. troops on December 22nd. When the shooting was over, 1 U.S. soldier and 51 Panamanians, including civilians, members of the paramilitary dignity battalions, and soldiers, were dead. Under an agreement with the soldiers, the merchants kept their guns. The names of the 25 U.S. soldiers killed during the invasion rolled across TV screens around the world. Yet a register of Panamanians killed during the invasion has never been published, even in Latin America. Many people after the invasion took it as a given that U.S. military bases would stay in Panama after 1999, despite the Canal Treaty's provision for them to leave. And that was actually part of the blueprint of Bush Sr.'s plan was to keep at least Howard Air Force Base and a number of other key bases in the canal area. But the U.S. said that they would set up a democracy. And that democracy decided 9 years later that the citizens did not want the military to stay. And it was really a mark of the civil society mobilization that prevented the military from staying. I want to make a little analogy here, too, because it's very similar to the Turkish parliament's rejection of a U.S. military agreement earlier this month. The Pentagon was stunned by the rejection. This was also true when Panama decided not to have extended military bases there. The Pentagon thought it would be a cakewalk, and instead they faced very broad opposition. And so this is one reason why the State Department, in a high-level memo that was written in February, has already said that the democracy in Iraq and other Middle Eastern countries is actually a bad idea, because it might not yield pro-U.S. outcomes. And so there's already dissent within the elites about what's going to happen in a post-invasion Middle East. In both cases, the country, Turkey or Panama, was to host, be the host country, so-called, for thousands of troops for use in a war on the southern border of that host nation. And in both cases, the political class wanted international cover to counter the unpopular bases. They needed the support of the international community. In the case of Turkey, they needed the support of the UN Security Council. In the case of Panama, they needed the support of other Latin American countries, and other Latin American countries did not want the U.S. bases to stay in Panama or were ambivalent at best. And so on the very day that the U.S. negotiator came to Panama in January of 1998 to initial the agreement, they said they thought they had a deal, and Thomas McNamara came to Panama City to initial the agreement, and instead Panama's foreign minister walked out of a meeting with the foreign ministers of Brazil, Mexico, and Colombia and said, "We don't have regional support. And without that regional support, we can't do this." In addition, the agreement itself was leaked to a Mexican daily and published in a Mexican daily. And when the details of the agreement came out, they were so prejudicial to Panama, they were so one-sided, that there was mobilization among both the elites and in the grassroots against this military base agreement. And at that point, it began to unravel. The rejection was followed by the United States blaming the government of Panama, and you also hear some blaming of the government of Turkey, basically for following a democratic process. Of course, the difference today between what happened with Panama and what happened, what's happening today, is that today, unlike following the invasion of Panama, or even before the invasion of Panama, which we could all see it coming, is that today there is worldwide opposition. Today, there is a mobilization that is unprecedented, probably in the history of the world. And so I just want to close by reading something that I got by email today. I know a lot of people are depressed today, and this actually cheered me up. This is from Paulo Coelho, who I don't know if any of you know. I just looked at some of his novels here. He's apparently the world's most popular novelist. He's from Brazil. And it's an open letter to President Bush. It's a thank you letter. And I'll just read this to you. "Thank you, great leader George W. Bush. Thank you for showing everyone what a danger Saddam Hussein represents. Many of us might otherwise have forgotten that he used chemical weapons against his own people, against the Kurds and against the Iranians. Hussein is a bloodthirsty dictator and one of the clearest expressions of evil in today's world. But this is not my only reason for thanking you. During the first 2 months of 2003, you have shown the world a great many other important things and therefore deserve my gratitude. So remembering a poem I learned as a child, I want to say thank you. Thank you for showing everyone that the Turkish people and their parliament are not for sale, not even for $26 billion. Thank you for revealing to the world the gulf that exists between the decisions made by those in power and the wishes of the people. Thank you for making it clear that neither José María Aznar nor Tony Blair give the slightest weight or to show the slightest respect for the votes they received. Aznar is perfectly capable of ignoring the fact that 90% of Spaniards are against the war, and Blair is unmoved by the largest public demonstration to date to take place in England in the last 30 years. Thank you for making it necessary for Tony Blair to go to the British Parliament with a fabricated dossier written by a student 10 years ago and present this as damning evidence collected by the British Secret Service. Thank you for allowing Colin Powell to make a complete fool of himself by showing the UN Security Council photos which 1 week later were publicly challenged by Hans Blix, the chief weapons inspector in Iraq. Thank you for adopting your current position and thus ensuring that at the plenary session, the French Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin anti-war speech was greeted with applause, something, as far as I know, that has only happened once before in the history of the UN, following a speech by Nelson Mandela. Thank you for making us feel once more that though our words may not be heard, they are at least spoken. This will make us stronger in the future. Thank you for ignoring us, for marginalizing all those who oppose your decision, because the future of the earth belongs to the excluded. Thank you, because without you, we would not have realized our own ability to mobilize. It may serve no purpose this time, but it will doubtless be useful later on. Now that there seems no way of silencing the drums of war, I would like to say, as an ancient European king said to an invader, may your morning be a beautiful one. May the sun shine in your soldier's armor, for in the afternoon I will defeat you. Thank you for allowing us, an army of anonymous people filling the streets in an attempt to stop a process that is already underway, to know what it feels like to be powerless and to learn to grapple with that feeling and transform it. So enjoy your morning and whatever glory it may yet bring you. Thank you for not listening to us and not taking us seriously. Know that we are listening to you and that we will not forget your words. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
That was John Lindsay Poland reading from an email by Paulo Coelho, considered by many to be the world's most popular novelist. John Lindsay Poland is the director of the Fellowship of Reconciliation's Task Force on Latin America and the Caribbean. He's also the author of Emperors in the Jungle, The Hidden History of the U.S. in Panama. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on John Lindsay Poland on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a copy of this program by calling us. TUC Radio is listener supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE. For information on how to order, you can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.